Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the WUNC studios at the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, it's Friday, May 26th, 2017. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Glad to have you along on this edition of the Politics Podcast, a roundup of longleaf happenings and a report on the recent record of state lawmakers in the courts. That story in about 20 minutes. First, a discussion on the week in North Carolina politics. Reminder, a shortened version of this conversation airs each Friday afternoon at 4:50. We record this at the Natural Sciences Museum in downtown Raleigh. Rob Schofield from the Liberal North Carolina Justice Center and Becky Gray with the conservative John Locke Foundation are back. Good to see you both.
Thanks, Jeff.
Good to see you, Jeff.
Snippets of the House budget proposal momentarily. First, another ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. On Monday, justices said Republican state lawmakers illegally gerrymandered two U.S. House districts, relying too heavily on race when drawing these congressional boundaries back in 2011. The decision affirms a lower court ruling. That decision invalidated the two boundaries and mandated lawmakers to redraw the maps last year. Listeners may remember that's why we had a second primary. So there are already new maps for these federal seats. However, Rob, we've talked plenty about redistricting and challenges to maps drawn by state lawmakers here on this program. Legal experts expect that Monday's ruling could have implications on another gerrymandering case pertaining to state seats. Tell us more.
Well, this is an endless series, it would seem, of these gerrymandering cases. But what the Supreme Court did this week was to enunciate a standard. They said, look, these maps that the North Carolina General Assembly drew for congressional maps were illegally racially gerrymandered. Here's why. People can read that opinion, as the lawmakers themselves undoubtedly read it. And we can see that the same standards that were used to draw those maps that were found unconstitutional were used to draw, arguably, legislative maps as well. And so there's a general expectation that at some point we'll have a decision striking down these legislative, you know, for the state legislative map as well. And that leads us then to the possibility of a special election in 2017 or an election in 2018 with different maps. And that obviously has a big potential impact, especially in this time, this very tumultuous political time in which we inhabit, in which obviously, the Trump administration has had such a bull in the China shop impact on politics nationally and here in North Carolina. And I think there's some feeling amongst progressives, Democrats, that it could, between those two things, that it could lead to some momentous election results that would perhaps shift the balance of power in the General Assembly. There's a lot of assumptions in there, though, because obviously, ultimately, unless the court sees the authority and draw the maps themselves, the legislators will be drawing the maps. We've seen how with the congressional maps, they were able to comply with court standards and still draw maps that were politically gerrymandered to favor Republicans. So a lot of variables out there. I think what's going to happen eventually, though, is we're going to get to this point at which the court is going to take a very serious look at the whole idea of partisan gerrymandering. There are these lawsuits that are proceeding there as well, not just racial gerrymandering, but the whole concept that legislators ought to be able to draw maps to favor one party or the other. And I think there's a growing body of belief that that is something that may happen soon, that the courts may find that we finally come to the point at which we need to strike that down as well.
How in the world do you undertake such a political exercise and draw political maps? How do you possibly take the partisanship out of it? I mean, how do you do that?
You can have a nonpartisan redistricting commission. It's been done in other states. You have a panel of experts who are nonpartisan. It's very difficult. I will concede that. But it's clearly there's some place where we can draw fairer and more logical maps than we have now. In a deeply purple, evenly divided state, the fact that Democrats get as many votes as Republicans and yet only elect 3 out of 13 members of Congress points to the fact that the maps are politically gerrymandered, and other states have done better at it. They have come up with systems to draw maps that roughly divide their states up into equal geographic areas and don't pay much attention to whose party is affected. I think that would be better if we moved in that direction. We've had support for that from Becky's group, from my group, from Republicans, from Democrats through the years, when they're out of power. I think we may be finally getting to the point at which both parties are going to realize that this is better for everyone.
Jeff, on the gerrymandering question, I think your point is really well taken. Where do you find a nonpartisan group of people to draw maps for elections, for very partisan elections? Where do those people exist? I would argue that rather than trying to find the people, the commission, whatever that might be, that the real key to this are the rules that are in place to do it. If you have really bright line, very carefully constructed, simple, easy to understand rules delegating how the gerrymandering is or how the maps are drawn, then it doesn't matter so much who draws them as how they are drawn. Now, what we're seeing with this different litigation through the courts and all is those rules being put into place. We have much more clear rules now than we did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, of how to draw those maps. The problem with some of these court cases, and this one on Monday is a great example of that, you know, what the courts came back and said, under the Voting Rights Act, we have to consider race in drawing the maps. But how much is
that?
That's the key. What's the answer to that? And the courts really didn't answer that question. They just said, what you presented us isn't it. You're going to have to try again. And so that bright line becomes very diffused, and there's confusing messages coming from the court, and it makes the General Assembly or whoever is drawing the maps, that job is impossible to do because the court won't tell you exactly what that looks like. Can you use partisan? Can you? You have to use race because we're a voting rights state. So it's a confusing message from the court that makes it more and more difficult to do that and really sets up, in my mind, just years and years and years of litigation because the court says, no, that's not it. Go back and try again. No, that's not it. Go back and try it again. Where's the right balance? I don't know the answer. And the court didn't tell us that on Monday.
I was just going to say that if we had a result where they drew a map where most parties were happy with the result, you wouldn't have the court stepping in like this. I mean, you could say it's impossible to draw the map. It's impossible to draw a map that doesn't violate these standards, that also is politically gerrymandered for the party in power. That's what the folks in power have been trying to do. They've been trying to draw maps that favor Republicans as much as possible. They've admitted that, and that at the same time comply with these standards in the Voting Rights Act. I think it's easy to draw maps if we have maps that roughly are fair to both parties.
I will note that Republicans challenged maps drawn by Democrats,
right,
coming
absolutely
out of the 2000 census. Democrats have applied many more challenges to the maps drawn by Republicans coming out of the 2010 census. Becky, let me ask you this before we move on. With this decision from the Supreme Court pertaining to the congressional maps, there seems to be a growing expectation for the legislative challenge as well. Are we moving toward a place of better governance and better maps, or are we just, you know, sinking deeper into chaos?
I hope that we're moving towards better maps. I think everybody does. I'm not sure that this court decision did that. And there's another case out there pending that has to do with how much can you consider partisanship in these maps. And until we get really bright line distinction and determination from the courts, I don't think that it's helpful in moving that way. Now, what the court does in this legislative case, and I expect we'll hear something in the next week or so on that particular mm-hmm. case. You know, we'll see if maybe there are better instructions if they do strike down the legislative races, which many people are saying it was done under the same criteria as the congressional maps. It just kind of connecting dots would have us believe that if you're betting on those kind of things, and who bets on court cases, but if you are, that is a likely determination from that court. Now, the instructions that they give may be much more helpful on that, but I think the courts have made this more difficult, they've made it more confusing, they've made it harder for whoever's drawing the maps.
In 10 years, the congressional delegation from North Carolina has gone from 8 Democrats and 5 Republicans to 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats. And I don't care where you are, right, left, or center, that is the product of map drawing more than anything else. That is not proportional to where the electorate in this state. I think we can all agree on that.
But other things that come into to context with that, too, is the quality of candidates that run, the amount of money that they can raise. And Republicans did extremely well in this last election nationally. Republicans did well in the statewide elections where there is no gerrymandering. You know, you run across the state. Roy Cooper was really the only Democrat that won a high-level North Carolina seat, and he barely won that race. Republicans picked up additional.
Josh Stein and Elaine Marshall.
Well, that's
are both
true.
Democrats.
Yeah, that's true. But Republicans picked up council of state races, so it was a good year for Republicans. Mm-hmm. So yes, Jeff, I absolutely agree. The congressional maps have been gerrymandered for political advantage, but it's not a done deal. You know, I mean, we've seen that in other races where good candidates, a lot of money, a good message, the other party can win
but
in
of
many
course,
of those elections.
Fair districts tend to attract stronger candidates and more funding from contributors as well. If they know that they have a shot, then you're more likely to draw good candidates to run it on.
Meanwhile, this decision comes a week after the Supreme Court decided not to hear an appeal to the state's invalidated voter ID law. That law was struck down by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals for illegally burdening Black and Latino voters. These are the latest defeats for Republican lawmakers in the courts, both state and federal. WUNC did an analysis of laws passed by the General Assembly since 2011, laws that faced major or what we call facial legal challenges. Three of these laws were ultimately upheld. 15 laws have either been overturned altogether or had key provisions struck down, and at least six cases are still pending. That is an improper formula. I mean, there's much more to it than just saying 3 and 15 and 6, but using that is the basic framework of how the legal challenges have gone. In its simplest form, the Republicans have a losing record in court right now. But with those as the facts and the loose framework, what do you make of that?
I think that legislatures, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, should pay closer attention to the Constitution as they're passing laws, is the first thing. Now, the Republicans have said, well, they've gotten a bum rap because many of the judges lean Democrat, are Democrats, were appointed by the Obama administration. I mean, that's been some of their comeback. I don't know enough about that to really say too much about that. I think that the record, Jeff, as you, and by the way, good job on that report.
Thank you.
It is kind of telling. And I think that everybody, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, anybody in public office, anybody making these decisions, should pay closer attention to the Constitution. It's a rule book. It's not a list of suggestions.
Rob.
Well, yeah, you're right. There's been a long losing streak, often with conservative Republican judges joining. Clarence Thomas, of course, joined in with this most recent decision on gerrymandering. But voter suppression, gerrymandering, abortion rights, local redistricting, judicial retention elections, North Carolina Association of Educator dues, those are some of the cases they've lost. I think it's really sort of the same thing that's been happening at the federal level with the Trump administration. Conservative leaders in power have really been pushing the envelope. They've been pushing the envelope in terms of remaking the American social contract. They have a notion of where they want to take the country. Courts have been saying no in a lot of instances. And I think, in turn, that explains what we're seeing in the General Assembly this year, which is this sort of war on the courts. We're seeing that at the federal level as well, where the folks in power are now trying to remake the courts. We've talked about court packing, shrinking the Court of Appeals, changing its duties, ending specialty courts, all with the objective of bending the results we get out of the courts. So it's increasingly the case that our courts are becoming politicized. And the folks in power right now have being unhappy with the results they're getting or going about it very strongly to remake the courts in an image that they feel more comfortable with.
Well, I think both parties and both sides have been guilty of, as Rob says, bending the courts. It is an important part of the three branches of government, mm-hmm. in many cases becoming more and more powerful. As we're seeing with many of these cases, Jeff, as you outlined in your piece that you did, the General Assembly passes laws, the governor can veto or not, they can be overridden or not, signed into law, but then the courts ultimately, in many of these very important decisions, are the ones that are the final word on this, which really I think brings to mind of who serves on those courts, how important it is, how we need to pay attention to it as voters. In North Carolina, we get to vote on our judges for Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. and then some, many of the others are appointed. But, you know, these are important elections, and I think that often it's kind of a down-ballot thing. A lot of the judicial races and candidates don't have voter fatigue. They don't have a lot of money to put into campaigns and those kind of things. But it is becoming more and more the most important, the most persuasive mm-hmm. branch of government. Who sits on those courts, whether they reflect your values, whether they're activist judges trying to set a culture, or whether they are letter of the law constitutionalists, is a really important decision that I think all of us need to take much more seriously. And I think this discussion today, the piece that you did, and this whole discussion of, you know, things moving through the General Assembly and how they end up in court, really illustrates how important the judicial races are, how important who those individuals that sit on those courts are, and why we need to pay attention to it.
All right, on to the budget. Like a leaky faucet, some of the House provisions and elements of the spending plan dripped out this week. What struck you both as most significant, noteworthy? We're recording this on a Thursday. Mm-hmm. We will get the full budget on the Tuesday after Memorial Day. So conceding we only know a sliver of what we're going to know, what struck you?
Well, we don't know the big picture yet. We don't know what the House proposes to do on taxes, on pay raises, on pensions and retirement. We do know that they're going to adhere to this same old sort of lousy process in which people can't really offer amendments unless they take it out of another specific line item that's in their particular area. We saw that in committees on Thursday. So that was unfortunate. There was one small, good, important improvement in the House version of the budget, which was the decision to remove this, at least as far as I can tell, they've mm-hmm. removed this provision that Senator Ralph Heiss led the insertion of in the Senate that would have cost 133,000 people their food assistance, including 51,000 children. They got just blasted in the editorials over the last couple weeks, the Senate did. So I'm hopeful that the fact that the House has taken that out is a sign of hope from the perspective of making government work.
And some education spending that came out at 3 in the morning is back in this House version of the proposal. Becky, what struck you?
Well, of course, you know, as you mentioned, it is like a leaky faucet. We don't have details yet, and I'm very interested in what that's going to look like, the bigger picture. But what we do know is that the spending is going to be the same as the Senate, $22.9 billion. So, first of all, that's going to cut down on the negotiations between the two bodies. That's what we've seen in past years, is just the amount of spending that they wanted to do led to weeks and weeks and weeks of discussion.
Right.
They have agreed that they're going to do that at $22.9 billion, which is about a 2.75% increase, which is under the growth of population and inflation, which is 3.8%. So what
is that too small for you?
That's just about right for me, to be honest with you. I think that is prudent spending. I think that is a strong message to send to North Carolina citizens, that they are keeping the growth of government, reining that in to a reasonable amount. So that's probably my biggest takeaway of the things that we know right now in the budget. I'll be watching for, as Rob mentioned, the tax package. They have talked about a tax package reduction of about $300-400 million. Since that, there is additional revenue that has come in, a revenue surplus. So we may see an increase in the tax cuts. I think that's a good idea. The other thing I'm really looking at is how much money they'll put into savings. We saw that in the Senate. The Senate's budget would bring savings up to the highest level that I think it's ever been in state government. Putting that money aside, if we didn't learn anything through Hurricane Matthew, it's that it's really important to put money away in savings accounts for literally a rainy day and other emergencies as they may come up. So I'll be watching next week for when that budget comes out and we get the bigger picture of what the House has proposed.
We will discuss the budget next week for sure. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of Research at NC Policy Watch, part of the North Carolina Justice Center. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff.
In today's economic climate, there is only one sure bet. The world is changing, and at the speed of light. As technology continues to improve the pace and success of the global marketplace, high-quality information is your most important ally in an increasingly uncertain world. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As the day's events unfold, join us for all the latest financial news and analysis from around the globe. Later on Marketplace from American Public Media.
Welcome back. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. State lawmakers were handed their latest legal defeat this week when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Republican legislators illegally gerrymandered two congressional districts. The justices said that lawmakers relied too heavily on race when drawing maps in 2011. This decision comes a week after the High Court passed on hearing an appeal to the state's controversial voter ID law that was struck down by a lower court last summer. Since 2011, more than a dozen Republican-backed bills have been struck down in federal and state courts. Progressives claim that judicial record shows a pattern of unconstitutional policy, while conservative lawmakers contend judges with an ideological bent are the true culprit. Here's a report. For 6 years, Republicans have been making the laws in North Carolina, and Democrats have occasionally been taking them to court. A voter ID law ruled unlawful, a plan to remove career status for veteran teachers struck down, and redistricting efforts in Wake and Guilford County overturned. In December, during a special legislative session, then-Governor-elect Roy Cooper offered this.
If I believe that laws passed by the legislature hurt working families and are unconstitutional, they will see me in court. And they don't have a very good track record there.
Within weeks, Cooper sued. As Attorney General, he chose not to defend some of the laws he viewed as unconstitutional. In less than 5 months as governor, he has already sued the General Assembly multiple times, accusing the legislature of illegal power grabs. Trying to determine the actual legal track record of Republicans over these past few years is not a simple exercise. State laws are regularly challenged in civil and criminal cases, generally one person disputing a law as it affects them. Then there are a few more broad challenges. These are called facial or constitutional claims, and often come from interest groups. It's all a maze of judicial filings, injunctions, rulings, dismissals, and upcoming arguments, with much more litigation likely to come. There are clear victories and defeats, other cases where both sides can claim a win, and plenty of cases that are pending. There's a lot of gray area. Meredith College political science professor David McLennan summarized it like this.
I think right now we look at it as, you know, a lot of victories for Democrats or progressives in the state and a few for Republicans.
WUNC did an analysis of laws passed by the legislature since 2011 that later faced major challenges in court. Three laws were ultimately upheld, surviving intact. 15 laws were either overturned altogether or had key provisions struck down, and at least 7 prominent cases are still pending. Lawmakers and staff members from the right and left are quick to tell you why each of those cases still hanging in the balance should be tallied as a victory for their side. That's where things stand for now. When considering all this, however, simply saying the legislature has a record of 3-15 in court only begins to tell the story.
We live in an era where everything that is legislated is litigated.
John Davis is a nonpartisan political analyst. To be fair, not everything gets challenged. Sometimes it just feels that way. Since Republicans claimed control of the legislature for the first time in more than a century back in 2010, close to 2,000 bills have become law. The overwhelming majority of those were not controversial and passed with wide bipartisan support. But some of the legislation has been highly contentious, redistricting, abortion regulations, and elections among them. And in the past 6 years, the General Assembly has spent $12.7 million on outside legal counsel. That's according to the latest figures from legislative staff. Of those 15 laws struck down, some were ruled unconstitutional in the U.S. Supreme Court, others in the state Supreme Court, some in federal court, and a few by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia.
Their biggest barrier has been a federal district court in Richmond with 15 members, 10 of whom were appointed by Democrats, 5 by Republicans.
For a case to even get to the Fourth Circuit, it signals that Republicans prevailed in a lower court. The bench in Richmond was once considered among the most conservative of all the appellate courts. Today, that has changed, and it's widely considered among the most liberal.
So basically, the deck has been stacked against them. They get to that body, and that body is made up of, unfortunately, as bad as I hate to say it, there truly is an ideological bias on the U.S. Supreme Court and on all these federal courts.
Like the many lawsuits against the legislature that are still pending, the balance of power in who rules on all these claims is fluid. At the state level, Republicans have pursued major policy agenda items in recent years. At the federal level, Democrats have a majority of the bench, and their authority was enhanced for more than a year with only 8 justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. Any ties there revert back to the lower court's decision. However, the dynamic is changing, with Neil Gorsuch recently joining the high court. Again, political scientist David McLennan.
What happens in the next 6 to 12 months could change what we've experienced over the last couple of years in terms of victories for liberals or progressives.
One of the conservatives who is glad to see a change on the high court is State Representative David Lewis, a Republican from Harnett County.
I think that many of the decisions that the Fourth Circuit have made have been purely political and have been designed to be not only political but inflammatory. And I hope that the Supreme Court will step in and put the brakes on some of this miscarriage of justice.
Lewis was the primary sponsor of the voter ID law, enacted by lawmakers in 2013, ruled unconstitutional by the Fourth Circuit last summer, and declined to be heard on appeal by the U.S. Supreme Court last week. It's the end of a saga, though not really. Lewis indicated another voting law is possible in the coming months, and there's a decent chance another legal challenge will follow. All right, that's all we've got. Thank you for tuning in to the WUNC Politics Podcast. It drops each week, Thursdays or Fridays. Feel free to disseminate the program via Facebook and Twitter, subscribe through iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, and, of course, stay informed with political stories at our website, WUNC.org. Enjoy your weekend.